Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of History Hack. I've got Kate with me today. Hello, Kate. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. Cooler than many people at the moment, I believe.
Look, look, don't you sit there and start getting smug with us. So we're recording this in the midst of that heat wave in which everybody's saying that Britain basically burnt to a cinder and there's nothing left and apparently we're all dead. So up until that moment where I get the memo that we are in fact all dead and have been reduced to puddles, we're going to keep going with History Hack because, hey, we might as well keep you entertained as the world crumbles. Who are we talking to today and why is this one going to be particularly fun?
So today we are talking to Simon Forder, who's an historian and author and an expert on castles. I love castles, so I'm very excited to speak to Simon today. He's also the author of Fortress Scotland, Edinburgh Castle and the Romans in Scotland and the Battle of Mons Graupius. And I do apologise if I've pronounced that terribly. So perhaps, Simon, you'd like to correct my awful pronunciation.
No, that Mons Graupius is correct. That's fine.
Fantastic. I must admit, when I was researching this one, I was like going through all the names and various words and thinking like, gosh, I need to check how to pronounce some of these things.
It's Latin. No, it's bound to be tough. We've all been there.
Well, it is. They are Latin words, but a rough guideline is that if you work on an Italian pronunciation, then you're probably going to be okay.
Ah, cool. Interesting.
I don't speak Italian, so I speak Spanish. Is that close enough?
It'll do.
So in general terms, I mean, we're going to focus today on the Romans in Scotland. In general terms, how much presence do the Romans have in Scotland? And I'm thinking kind of in comparison to the rest of Europe, because we think of it very much as the sort of the borderland. I was talking to Simon Elliott the other day, who was describing Britain as kind of the Wild West of the Roman period, which I thought was a great metaphor. So if you're on the fringe of the Wild West, that sounds like a place which is not kind of the center of Roman control. So how much presence is there? How much projection of power is there compared to other parts of the empire?
Well, the short version is that the northern half of Britain was very much a militarized zone. There were some settlements that could be categorized as Roman towns of a sort, but by and large, they were side effects of the military presence. So everywhere where the army had a temporary or a permanent garrison, there would be small settlements would grow up that supplied the needs of the army and of the garrison. And so we really ought to think that Simon Elliott's description is pretty accurate, because the military were the predominant force, and that meant that you had no socialization in real terms. There were no great Roman cities with bathhouses and all the facilities that people in the empire elsewhere would have recognized as being truly Roman. And it was also the case that in terms of worship, the military gods and goddesses were the main things that appeared. And quite often in the inscriptions that we find in the northern half of Britain and Scotland are either military gods and goddesses, or they would almost acquire the local gods and goddesses and incorporate them into their worship. So everything to do with the army, with military, with soldiers, with patrols going out and trying to dominate and harass the natives is what we would think of. And in that regard, it was very much a case that it was similar to no other part of the empire. All the way along the Rhine frontier, the Danube frontier, all the way along the frontier over in the Middle East and across North Africa, it was the case that there were these large settlements, that it was much more a Mediterranean and imperial feel. Now, one of the things that I actually did earlier this week is I went out to an archaeological dig at a quarry about 4 or 5 miles from Elgin, which is right up near Inverness in the north of Scotland. And what they've found is evidence of industrial scale iron smelting. And what that is basically an example of is local entrepreneurs choosing to become suppliers of raw materials to the army, because there was no other centralized organization in the north of Scotland that would have any need for high grade iron. And the dating evidence that they have found at that site is very much consistent with the second half of the first century AD for perhaps a century or so. And that coincides very, very nicely with the presence of the Roman army in Scotland. And as soon as the army withdrew, they pulled the bottom out of that particular market. All of a sudden, the entrepreneurs had nobody to sell their high-grade iron to, and they abandoned the site. And in the archaeology that they're digging up, they're finding very high-value raw iron ore, along with unused charcoal, all of which was very, very expensive. It required time and effort to produce among the local economy. But they left it, which indicates that whilst the army has a very tangible presence in terms of soldiers walking around, it's also the case that the wider supply chain of all the materials that the army needed was also a physical presence in terms of the border region.
So we can learn quite a lot from archaeological sources. What other sources are there that tell us about the time that the Romans were in Scotland?
There aren't very many, to be honest. There's a very famous piece of writing produced by Tacitus, which is the autobiography of his father-in-law, Gnaeus Julius Agricola. And he was a Roman general and the governor of the province of Britannia. And the autobiography that Tacitus produces is basically telling us of all the activities, all the campaigns, all the things that his father-in-law did. And whilst he may not be the most reliable written resource in terms of the Roman Empire as a whole, for Scotland, he's pretty much it for this period. We have no mention prior to Tacitus at all, other than occasional references to Caledonia, to the King of the Orcades, which is mentioned in with reference to the Emperor Claudius. But really, it's just a case of there are, apart from Tacitus, there is very, very little telling of what events were going on. There's just occasional references to the barbarians did this or the Picts did that. And beyond that, there isn't very much at all. It's only after that, and we're talking towards the latter period of the Roman involvement in Scotland, that a geographer called Ptolemy produced a document which is called the Geography. And that geography describes a list of places which are largely the they largely correlate with the Roman forts, the permanent occupation of the area, together with geographical features on the coastline. And he then cross-references that with the names of tribes of people. Now, that really is all that we have. So when we're looking beyond archaeology, and we then look at Tacitus as potentially something we need to treat with a great deal of care, we really are looking at a very, very fragmentary record.
Well, that leads us very nicely into where we wanted to go next with this, which is Tacitus himself. And you talk about, you know, kind of the, you know, Tacitus has been accepted for a long time as the knowledge, but as you're kind of saying, you know, what's being found in a more tangible sense is disproving a lot of what is said by Tacitus. So why was he accepted as being accurate for so long? Is it kind of just a lack of alternative information?
To a degree, yes. I mean, the main story of Tacitus is that he describes a 7 or 8 year period when his father-in-law was the governor. There is no other example anywhere in imperial history and in gubernatorial history that describes the career of a senior member of Rome's civil service. And what we have with Tacitus is a story that tells of an advance into Scotland and a retreat. And the even as early as the 18th century, General Roy recorded known Roman sites in Scotland. And the as time progressed over the next 150 years or so, it was very, very clear that the general context of what Tacitus wrote of advance, short occupation, and retreat was it was very closely matched by this archaeological evidence in terms of the marching camps that existed. And because of this, and because there wasn't anybody else who was contradicting what he was saying, with regards to the Agricola, which is the autobiography that he wrote, nobody really had any reason to challenge it. And it's only in more recent years as the science of archaeology has developed and things are able to be dated with more accuracy. People are able to see in a lot more detail what a camp was. We are able to actually date camps in different phases and different types, that it started to become clear that there were inconsistencies. And an example would be that he would describe a particular event, and he would say, this is what happened. The barbarians did this. This was the response of Agricola, and the Romans did this. And then Agricola was victorious, and this is the reason for it. And everybody thought Agricola was a great guy. Now, Tacitus was writing perhaps 15, 20 years after his father-in-law's death. And he was also writing in the reign of the Emperor Trajan. Trajan had succeeded, after a brief civil war, an individual who was widely perceived to be a tyrant, which was the Emperor Domitian. And there was a very strong senatorial response to Domitian's tyranny, and that involved criticizing him. So within Tacitus, we then look at the subtext of the politics of his time, whereby he was very clearly intending to do down the emperor's decisions, which included pulling Agricola back out of Scotland and abandoning all his hard work, and at the same time extolling the ideals of the senators in Trajan's time, which was good behavior, moderation, being considered wise, being considered benevolent, never making mistakes. And within that context, you then start to see patterns whereby Tacitus is reproducing almost by rote standard tropes, I guess, of the imperial period, which when you then take those standardizations of wording and events out of it, they start to pull apart the story that he is telling and leave it with some very, very telling holes. And that causes us to ask questions about his overall reliability. Of course, it's still the case that he's the only written resource that we have from that time, which means that whilst we have to challenge him, we also have to work within the general guidelines of all of the other information we have. We can't just go on a Tacitus demolishing exercise without having the arguments to back it up.
So we've touched a couple of times on buildings the Romans sort of left behind and evidence of buildings. What sort of buildings would they have built and why? Can you tell us a bit more about sort of the purpose and construction of these buildings?
Yeah, absolutely. They're, principally, we need to categorise the presence of Roman structures in Scotland as either being temporary or permanent. In that first category, we have the temporary marching camps. And these traditionally have been described as things that the Roman legions dug up overnight. They dug a ditch, they threw all the earth on the inside to form a bank, and then they stuck timber fence all the way around the top. And they then set up an army, a kind of infantry camp full of leather tents. Now, traditionally, again, it's been the case that these have been presumed to mark very, very short periods of occupation, where the army enter a place, they dig their camp, they stay there for a couple of days, a week at most, absolutely trash the landscape around them, and then move on as part of a process of conquest. And that, to a certain extent, that is true. However, the time frame of occupation has been now proven to be anything up to 3 or 4 months. So rather than it being a case of the marching camps being very short-term military occupation, they also then used as part of the process of dominating and exploiting and overawing the surrounding countryside. And the overwhelming majority of these marching camps, there is nothing at all left of them apart from crop marks, because they were used for one season, abandoned. And when the army came back the next time, they could have had less soldiers, they could have had more cavalry. So they, whilst they may reuse the site, they then just redesign it. And against that, we have the permanent structures. In Scotland, the majority of that falls into the category of a fort, a garrison fort. And these were much, much smaller buildings. They form an enclosure that probably falls into the category of maybe a dozen acres or so. It would be defended with multiple ditches and banks, and it would have stone walls around the perimeter instead of timber. And within this, they would build barrack blocks, they would build granaries, there would be a central headquarters for that fort, which would contain the commanding officer's personal residence. It would contain the fort's temple, where the legion's standards and so on were stored for good luck. And it would contain, normally it would contain some form of bathing, as well as potentially stables and granaries. These forts would be occupied for dozens of years. The intention would be that they would be permanent occupation, but the nature of warfare in Scotland meant that they could be abandoned after 10, 15 years and then reoccupied 3 or 4 years later when the army returned. Outside of that, those forts, we have small settlements built up called Viki, which are villages that contain things that the soldiers might want on their nights off. There would be, potentially they might have families there, they might have other ladies of leisure who serve their needs. They might have inns, they might have takeaway restaurants, because the Romans actually did street food quite well. And they would probably be a marketplace of some sort where people from the surrounding area would bring their wares to sell to the army. And this would largely be raw material, because the army itself contained its own craftsmen to repair the tents, to repair the armor and all this, but they didn't necessarily have the skill set to produce the iron, to produce and cure the leather and all of this kind of stuff. So we would be talking about very, very small settlements outside garrison forts. And the garrison forts had people who they could spend their entire 25 years as a legionary working within the fort and going out on patrol. And they could even be drawn from the native populations. And certainly there, within Scotland, we also have one example of a legionary fortress, which was started. And this would have contained it would have become the provincial capital in time of North Britain. And they started building this, they excavated, they started digging all the foundations for massive numbers of buildings to service the needs of anything up to 10,000 military personnel, including the service people who worked alongside the soldiers. But that was then abandoned. And the Romans withdrew from that area, and they buried tons upon tons, and I'm talking literally tons, of iron nails that had great value. They clearly intended to return and finish off building, but they never did.
Can we know why, or can we speculate why?
Why was it abandoned, or why did they not return?
Or why either, both.
Well, it comes back to this delightful tyrant Domitian, and he basically had a problem in that there was substantial rebellion and warfare running along the East European boundary, which was the River Rhine and the River Danube. And what he needed to do was he needed to reorganize the garrisons and the legions across the empire in order to counter this substantial military threat. Because when we think about Eastern Europe, we don't really think about it as being particularly close to Rome and Italy. But the Lower Danube, we're talking in what's now Bulgaria and Romania. If you had a hostile army cross the Danube, and the Romans built bridges across the Danube, they could, within a week, easily be inside Italy. So what Domitian did, quite rationally, was to say, this thing that we've got going on in Scotland, I really need those 10,000 men. I need those men over on the Danube. So what we'll do is we'll pull them out of Scotland into York. The legion that's in York will pull south into the south of England, and the legion in the south of England will send into France and over onto the continent to defend the empire's borders, because people in Rome, who of course were, there were quite a lot of them in comparison, they were much more likely to see barbarians crossing the Danube and coming into provinces that they may have even got trading relationships with as a bigger threat than something in the far north of Scotland. And when Domitian had done that, it was basically the case that the war carried on, and the legions were never sent back, certainly not in volumes that were big enough to warrant reoccupying the legionary fortress site.
So let's talk about one of the big ones, if you will, the one everybody knows about. We're going to be predictable. We have to talk about Hadrian's Wall, right? You know, it's the one that you talk about Scotland, you talk about the Romans, everybody goes, oh yeah, Hadrian's Wall, that was built to keep the Scots out because the Scots weren't popular with the Romans. It's a big defensive barrier, but it's not quite right, is it? There's a bit more going on there. So what kind of purpose did the wall actually serve, and how effective was it in fulfilling that purpose? My understanding is it's some kind of tax barrier.
Broadly speaking, yes. I mean, I've said how Domitian pulled the troops out of Scotland, and he pulled them right back to an old frontier line called the Stanegate. And the Stanegate was basically a sequence of forts and camps and earthworks that was built along the line that Hadrian's Wall now occupies. And it was always intended at that point to be a temporary structure while they consolidated land behind it. Now, Trajan really didn't have a great deal to do with Scotland, and it was his adoptive son Hadrian who then took over after him. So we're talking maybe 25, 30 years after Scotland had been abandoned by Domitian. Now, what had happened, and there is a grey area here, but what had happened was there appears to have been a substantial influx of barbarians from north of the Stanegate into northern England, as it is now. And the Romans appear to have suffered a fairly substantial military defeat at that time. But true to all propagandists, they never really told anybody about it. So Hadrian had been asked by the governor to come to Britannia to look at the border and to bring the imperial presence in all its might and glory to overawe the area. So he did that. He came with his master masons, he came with his dancing girls, he came with everything that Rome had to offer to make themselves look splendid. And he elected to say, right, this is where the Roman province ends. So a tax barrier is, to a degree, what it was about, because anything that came from outside the province coming through Hadrian's Wall into Britannia proper would therefore be taxed, and anything that was being traded outside of the empire with the tribes beyond could be monitored as well. But it was more of a symbolic statement than anything else. It was Hadrian saying, this is where the empire stops. There is nothing beyond it but blue-painted barbarians. Now, in terms of its effectiveness, as a military barrier, it was utterly ineffective because it was the army itself and the legions and the garrisons that occupied Hadrian's Wall that were the critical thing. There was a demilitarized zone to the north and to the south where only the soldiers were allowed to be, apart from the few roads that then passed through the wall, through certain places, and allowed scouting parties, traders, and anybody else who wanted to go into the lands to the north of Hadrian's Wall. And as soon as there was any kind of major uprising north of Hadrian's Wall, it became very clear that it was easily overrun, and it was repeatedly overrun throughout the remaining 300, 350 years of Roman history in Britain. And, you know, it's also the case that when Scotland was a nation of these so-called blue-painted barbarians, they also had ships, they had boats, they traded with Ireland, they traded north with Orkney, with Shetland, they traded across the North Sea with Scandinavia. And that meant that when you have a nice stone wall running from one side of the country to the other, all that it took to mount a successful invasion was to sail around the end of it. You know, you could just get your boat, a few thousand troops on it, maybe a couple of hundred small boats. You sail around, you go into the lower lying lands of the Lake District, and you could just raid and pillage as your mind took you. Going the east side, you had the River Tyne, you had the River Tees, you have the Humber. All of these major rivers that lead straight from the coast into the heartland of the province. So from that point of view, it didn't function as a military barrier in any way, shape or form. It is purely the case that the military garrisoned it. The soldiers were there, and that's what made it a military structure. And, you know, was it possible for it to function as a proper tax point? Not really, for the same reason. You could just sail a boat round the other end. Unless you have a very effective customs force around the entire coastland of Britannia, which, of course, they didn't, it would be very difficult to stop the black market from operating exactly as it wanted to. So for me, it's very much a case of the symbolism of saying, this is where the empire stops, and beyond it, you are not part of the empire. It's almost a case of further north than that, they weren't worthy. But of course, all the time you have small groups of soldiers, probably bands of a couple of hundred at a time, going out on patrol and monitoring the lands to the north, probably as much as 15, 20 miles beyond the wall. And the other thing to bear in mind is that when we look at the archaeological record of the earlier period of conquest, there is very little evidence, particularly along the eastern side of the country. So we're talking the Berwickshire and East Lothian area. There's very little evidence of any warfare. There are marching camps, but it would appear that the locals in those areas were perfectly happy to commit to alliances and trading alliances, in particular with Rome, with the province. So they were never a hostile group anyway, which means that you potentially have more of a problem in the central area over the Pennines and over towards Dumfries and Galloway. And if that is the case, and we're talking about a military strategy, why would you have a military strategy covering the entirety of that border when a third of the boundary could well have been with friendly nation?
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? And Hadrian's wasn't the only wall the Romans built, was it? Can you tell us about the other wall that they built in Scotland?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, the wall that also exists in Scotland is the Antonine Wall. And the Antonine Wall is a much, much shorter structure. It goes from the River Forth across to the River Clyde. So we're talking in between Edinburgh and Glasgow for those not hugely familiar with Scottish geography. And that's probably about 35 or 40 miles. It's very, very, very heavily populated with forts. And the army occupied that in very large numbers and in a very high density. And they could certainly occupy it far easier as a defensive frontier than Hadrian's Wall, which was maybe three or four times as long to the south. And the reason it happened was because Hadrian's Wall proved indefensible and non-functional when there were invasions. After Hadrian died, we have another period whereby there are great barbarian uprisings along the Danube, along the Rhine in particular. And there are, again, many references to the wall, quote and unquote, being crossed by barbarians and the province of Britannia being raided. Now, given that was the case, given that at least one of the major tribes to the north of the wall was actually a friendly allied tribe, it made sense for the Emperor Antoninus Pius to move the frontier north again and to say, right, we are going to defend north of this. We are going to put a boundary here that we can defend against these raiding people coming down. And this was occupied on two separate occasions. It was occupied by Antoninus Pius and It was then abandoned after maybe 10, 11 years, and the frontier was drawn back down to Hadrian's Wall. It was then reoccupied again about another 20 years later, and then finally abandoned a second time. And the wall itself, wall is a misnomer because there was never a wall as such. The structure of the Antonine Wall and all of the forts on it is entirely earth and timber. You have massive, massive ditches and banks that go across from one river to the other. They were probably crowned with a timber palisade of sharpened logs. The forts themselves, again, you have what we see today are ditches and banks, maybe two or three sets around a fort that contained maybe 500 men. And there is no evidence whatsoever at any point along Hadrian's Wall of there being any stone buildings. So whether it was the case that the intention was eventually for this to be restructured in stone, or whether it was entirely a military response to hostility to just basically make the invading Caledonians make their lives a little more difficult, we can't really tell at this point. And over and above the wall itself, there are maybe six or seven permanent forts that exist north of Hadrian's Wall, going up as far as Perth and possibly one beyond that, whereby these forts were reoccupied at the same time as the wall. So the Antonine Wall itself is a distinct feature in the landscape, but it was part of a wider frontier system of occupation that the Romans used at that point in time.
I'm going to switch tacks slightly and take us a little bit back to Tacitus again, because one of the things that comes up in your book is the Battle of Mons Graupius, I'm going to go with.
Graupius.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I stand corrected. Not surprised. My Latin was awful. now, Tacitus says that there's this great kind of sweeping victory, but I gather that we might have reason to question his accuracy. So talk us through what's supposed to have happened and the reasons why there's evidence to suggest that, you know, that that's not the case.
Okay. I shall, to a certain extent with Tacitus, there is a degree of tabloidism in what he says. So what I will, the way that I will explain what his version of the story is, may be seen as a little bit tabloid, but that is because it's how the guy wrote. Now, in effect, what he said is that after 4 or 5 years of steadily advancing northwards from England into Scotland, the Scots, who he refers to as the Caledonii, were getting very frustrated with the constant aggravation by the Roman forces. So they decided to form a grand alliance of tribes to oppose the Romans. And Tacitus got wind of, Agricola got wind of this, sorry. And he got an army together and marched northwards. And as he went, he had the navy supporting him. And eventually they found this this campsite that they felt was appropriate, and they got themselves all set up for the night. And when they got up in the morning, they could see the massed thousands and thousands of Caledonian savages ranked up on the slopes of the mountain in front of them, all baying for Roman blood. So what Agricola does is he gives this very stirring Braveheart style speech to the Roman troops, talking about what it is that they are fighting for Roman decency, for their family, for the dignity of the empire, for the glory of the emperor, and so on. And that, what do these barbarians have anyway? They have marshes, they live in the bogs, they they eat their children, they marry their cattle, you know, any kind of nonsense that he could put into this speech vilifying the barbarians, Tacitus puts into his father-in-law's mouth. And he then tells that the leader of the Scots, a gentleman by the name of Calgacus, which just means swordsman, gave an equally stirring speech to the Caledonians and said about how the Romans were taking away their freedom and how they were going to be slaves and that they were fighting for their homelands and so on. And after this, the very civilized exchange of speeches to their troops, the Romans set themselves up and sent in the auxiliaries, who were the non-Roman citizen soldiers, to fight the Caledonians. The Caledonians then fought very bravely, causing Agricola to have to send in some additional cavalry, who were also not Roman citizens. And they basically utterly destroyed the Caledonian advance. And the Caledonians then fled into the bogs and the forests, and the Romans were totally victorious. And he, you know, within that story, Tacitus gives us numbers that emphasize exactly how many tens of thousands of Caledonians there were. And this kind of emphasis on what a great victory his father-in-law had actually managed to inflict on these savages, after which they all tidied up and he awarded his troops with various decorations of valor. And he then sent a group of people further north to take hostages and make agreements with the savages and the tribes further north. And after which his victory was so complete and so spectacular that our dear emperor tyrant Domitian got jealous and basically called him back to Rome and put him into an honorable retirement of ignominy. So that is the story that Tacitus actually tells. But there are numerous issues associated with that.
So, I mean, it's possible that the Battle of Mons Graupius didn't even happen, or at least didn't happen as we've sort of always, in inverted commas, believed. So what do you think did happen? How do you think it really went down?
I think that there was a battle. I mean, it is the case that some people are inclined to utterly disregard Tacitus as utterly unreliable. Although Agricola himself was dead by the time he wrote, there were senior senators of great, great standing who had previously been involved in fighting in Britain. And there were people who could basically pull his story apart if he created the whole thing and made the whole thing up. Now, when looking at the detail of what it was that he says, what I did was I cross-referenced the numbers. I looked at how infantry camps were set up, how many people could occupy a square, an acre of land when they were in the 18th century and so on. And the whole idea was to try and work out whether any of the temporary marching camps across Scotland as a whole that had been identified so far could possibly match the criteria of a marching camp as described by Tacitus.
Yeah, because there's some discussion of where as well, isn't there? I probably should have asked that as well, that there's a kind of nobody really knows where.
Absolutely. So,
yeah, please tell us where you think it happened as well.
Oh, I will do. I will do. I mean, the problem that I had was I looked at the numbers and the numbers of soldiers that Tacitus describes as being present at the battle does not match with any known sequence of marching camps. And what that means is that either the army of the Romans was far bigger or much smaller than Tacitus would have us believe. The next thing that I did was I looked at the few geographical descriptions that Tacitus puts into his account of the battle, such as the Romans being able to see the Caledonians rank upon rank climbing up the slope in front of them. There's no mention at all that in any of the account that Tacitus puts together that there was a river of any significance on or near the battle site. And when I put all of this together, there was no exact match. In order for an army the size that Tacitus describes to fight a battle such as Tacitus describes, there's nowhere that fits, nowhere at all. But given that a battle probably took place, we then have to say, well, okay, so if none of them match exactly, how close can we get? And numerous people have done this over the years and have come up with various favoured locations for the battle. And the location that I came to the conclusion fitted most closely is just south of Perth. There are a number of marching camps in this area. Perth itself was the site of a permanent garrison fort that was established at around about this time. And there is a nice hill that matches the description that Tacitus gives, as well as there being sufficient space for a large pitched battle to have taken place. Now, I'm not saying that it's perfect, because it's not, but there is no perfect location for any camp that we've found so far. And one of the things that does make it quite compelling to me is that there is a hill just south of Perth called Moncrieff Hill. And when you look at Moncrieff Hill, it is a very prominent feature in the landscape. And it is conceivable that the actual name given to the hill, the mountain, and the battle, which is Mons Graupius, is actually it has come down in corrupt form as Moncrieff Hill. So I'm inclined to think that a good match for the location of the battle is around Moncrieff, south of Perth. Although I think that the battle itself may have been fought either around about the site of the city or to the south of the River Erne in an area around Abernethy, which was of great religious significance to the early Scots. So I think that a battle probably did take place. I think it was probably smaller scale than Tacitus would have us believe. It almost certainly was some kind of draw whereby there was a battle. Neither side came off particularly well, but the Romans, being more organized, were seen as being too big a threat for the Caledonians that came to fight them. And the other aspect that particularly interested me is a question of the timing of the whole thing. And the timing, as described by Tacitus, is that it happened in the late summer and autumn. And that is because he describes how news of Agricola's son's death came to Agricola. And he then went into a very stoic and approved period of mourning, and it was the idea of battle that got him out of it to a certain extent. And with the idea being that it was fought in late summer or autumn, it does seem quite feasible that a large raiding party came down into the much more fertile landscape around Perth in order to burn, destroy, or steal the harvest. Because even back then, there was the ability in lowland Perthshire for agriculture to flourish and for crops to be grown. And of course, to remove the grain, which a substantial proportion of that was probably supplied to the army for their food, would actually strike quite a nasty blow against the legions in Scotland. So that's what I think happened. I think it was a battle. I think it was probably much more inconclusive than would be led to believe. But the Romans were the ones who were able to leave the field with their heads held slightly higher.
Sadly, we're out of time, which is a real shame, because I could keep asking you questions about this for the rest of the afternoon. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
The Romans in Scotland, the Battle of Mons Graupius. There we go. I've learned to pronounce it properly now. Folks, it's available. You know all the usual things about where you can get it and me encouraging you to go direct to the publisher. I'll spare you the rant. Please do go buy the book. And Simon, thank you so much for your time. Make sure you come back and talk to us about some of the other work you've done. And we'll look forward to chatting again very soon.
Okay. Thank you for having me.